we live in a great place. I mean, we're talking like this. I'm drinking coffee. When I hear people like complain about something, it's like, fuck, man. Like, look at, we're on the brink of nuclear war. Not the brink, but you know, it's
we're
more
closer than we were when you and I talked.
Yeah, and every day is like another day of, you know, where is this all going to go? Because it's not getting better; it's getting worse.
Welcome to the Futures Edge podcast. I am Jim Murio.
And I'm Bob Iacino.
Today we have a special guest, Michael Ferris, who is the host of the podcast Coffee and Mike, which has fabulous, fabulous guests, two of which were Bobby and I. And now he's here. We have a lot of to talk about because I think what you've done on your podcast is tremendously interesting. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. Don't forget about Dave Collum. I mean, he's the one that famously nicknamed you two the Italian Stallions. So, which every time I, just the fact that I have both of you on talking to you together right now, I love that he calls you the Italian Stallions.
And I am very proud of my friendship that over the years with Dave Collum, but not around everybody because sometimes he's like, oh, you're friends with that crazy guy? Yes, I am friends with that crazy guy.
Proud of it.
So how did you get into the whole podcast thing? Tell us what you do, what you did.
You know, I didn't know anything about podcasting when I started this almost 6 years ago. And a friend of mine who I know in Scottsdale here suggested podcast. You should do a podcast. I'm like, well, I don't know what that is. And, I had a friend of mine help me and I thought, I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? Like, who am I going to talk to? And when it all started, it was more, I was doing them in person. I have an H6 recorder, and I was like, okay, well, I'll drive around Phoenix. I love running. I love boxing, food, and, you know, I'll start with chefs. And, I mean, Bobby, you and I talked about fighting and boxing. And he was my childhood hero, and I was fortunate enough to get him on my fifth or sixth episode was Freddie Roach, who, people that don't know, he trained Manny Pacquiao, Mike Tyson, and Oscar De La Hoya, and
absolutely.
I went down to L.A. and met up with him at Wild Card Boxing. And so then I was reaching out to people that just to ask to see if they'd be interested. And a couple of people I went to high school with had some success in L.A. and were able – my friend – guy was became a friend of mine later on. I mean, he's become a friend of mine now, but he was a writer for The Simpsons. So I reached out to him and I said, hey, I'm doing this podcast. You know, would you come on? He said, well – yeah, send me the link. And I wasn't doing anything remotely. It was all in person. I said, well, I'm going to be in LA, which I wasn't, but I'm like, I'm going to be in LA. If you want to meet at a coffee house, he goes, well, just come to my house. Better yet, just come to my office at Universal. Yeah, those were the first five or seven episodes. And then I'm from Cleveland. There's a James Beard chef in Cleveland that I grew up with too. So I was in Cleveland and every time I'd go somewhere, I would just see if I could connect with people and take my gear and do podcasts.
So as your podcast has gotten successful and you've gotten, I mean, you get great guests. I mean, you've had Kerry Lake on your show. You've had, you know, Dave Collum on your show. Does it get easier? It seemed to me that the tact you took was like, don't try to get Manny Pacquiao, but somebody, you know, who's behind the scenes, maybe someone who people don't know, but someone who's very, very important. But you get big names. Has it gotten easier?
I didn't go for like big people in the beginning because I thought, I mean, some of the relationships I had, like Freddie Roach, you know, I considered was big. But because of his relationship with my family, I was able to get that. That was the first podcast he actually ever did. And I tell the story. I told Bobby, he called Mickey Rourke a pussy on my podcast. Hilarious.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. But no, I was always like targeting, you know, there were certain people I wanted, and if I couldn't get them, I'd use Instagram, and I'm like, all right, who are they following? Who's following them? Let me just start to kind of work my way, baby step, to get towards those people. I didn't get all of them, but that was like my strategy. I wasn't on Twitter at all. I just used Instagram in the beginning. Yeah, I thought I got enough social media that I didn't want to, you know, how much more time in my day. And it was Lee Mignon who had on. She's the one that said, if you create a Twitter account, I'll retweet it. And that's the only reason why I created Twitter. And here I am, sucked in the rabbit hole.
It's interesting. Every time I think that the podcast space is saturated, oversaturated, and I think it is, I realize every time I go to YouTube or I go to Rumble, it's the first thing I do when I'm done with work now. I literally don't turn on the TV like I used to kind of decompress. I'll sit down in a chair, sit down in the yard, and I'll just go to YouTube or I'll go to Rumble. And I always find time to watch the shows I want to watch or listen to the shows I want to listen to. And Michael, yours is one of those. Matter of fact, you had some recent episodes that I'll bring up in a little bit that I really enjoyed. But I didn't know you until we sort of met through Dave Collum. And now yours is one of the shows I regularly listen to. The level of guests you get, I want to do a pitch for you before I ask you a question, because people don't understand. If you look at the names sometimes, like people may not know who Patrick Henningsen is from reading his name. And then you listen to the episode and you're both terrified and really happy that you got the amount of information you got from that kind of a guest. And would you correct me if I'm wrong? I think that's kind of the hallmark of your show. I mean, obviously, Freddie Roach is a legend. You and I already geeked out about boxing. I was on Michael's show and that was probably a quarter of the show.
We didn't even talk about finance. We talked about intermittent fasting, carnivore diet, and fighting.
What to me, from my perspective, like the podcast space, it's saturated, but it's not. What do you think about that statement?
I agree. You know what? When I first started, I was very intimidated because it was like everybody had a podcast. And I'm like, God, this person, they already got a built-in audience. Like, who am I? I don't have a built-in audience. I'm not on TV. I'm not any of that. And now it's to the point where I see them, because so many of them start and then they do a few episodes and they just stop for whatever reason. And because it's, you guys know, it's hard. Like it's fun, it's gratifying, but you have to line people up. You have to do research. You want to have a good conversation. And it's always, what have you done for me lately? Like, what's next? What's next? What's next? You know, who can I talk to? Who's, you know, who's interesting to me? If I can't get them, who's my backup? Then it becomes, you know, what work.
What exactly do you look to talk about? So I want to give people some background as to kind of who you are, because one of the things I realized when I did your show was you're pretty easy to take a conversation in any direction. What do you look to focus on when you get somebody on the show?
Right now, it's, you know, I'm trying to stay things that I find relevant in the world. You know, and let me just say this. I mean, it wasn't political in the beginning, right? It went with COVID. When COVID started, I had to do things remotely, and I just didn't want to sit back and not, you know, talk about what was going on. So now, as we approach the election, you know, we're what, 7 months away from it. I'm just with to me, what's important, like trending topics, and what I think people are really, not only what I'm interested in, but what people are interested in. So I'm shifting around between a couple of different areas right now. So, and I can get into that if you want to hear what I'm gravitating towards.
We'd love to, but I also want to point out that we don't find you political at all. Being like centrist and looking at things and not bowing to the left, I do not believe is political. We are just people who are, it allows all of us normals against the weirdness that's going on. I don't find it political, but please go on.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, but I also think too is, and maybe you guys agree with me. I mean, I think the right, not people like us that are talking, but the Republican Party is absolutely worthless to me. And I think we see it every single day. They do nothing. They stand for nothing. If the party collapsed tomorrow, I wouldn't even care because they don't do anything. But right now, I mean, my interest is, I mean, you know, Israel, Iran, the escalation in the Middle East, I find fascinating. I don't know if that's the right word, but, you know, it's where that goes.
Right? Yeah.
Russia, Ukraine has come back in the fold. The border is probably the number one topic in this country right now of concern. And your guys' expertise, I mean, financially, I mean, I'm very interested in, you know, commercial real estate and, you know, and these banks and, you know, the Federal Reserve. And I mean, that's what Paul Craig Roberts I had on earlier today. And, you know, he wrote a 3-part series talking about the Great Dispossession. It's on his website. It's really interesting, you know, talking about how if there's another banking crisis, the money in your accounts is, it's not yours. You know, they can take that, a Fidelity or the Charles Schwab, that money is basically, it kind of reminded me of the, I, you know, I didn't say this to him, but it's like when you buy something on iTunes, it's not really yours.
So what does he suggest as a solution to that? Stockpile hard assets, like physical hard assets?
You know, we didn't get into the whole gold or Bitcoin conversation. I mean, he was saying how, because the wealthy are going to experience this pain too if this actually occurs, if there's another banking crisis. And that the wealthy are the ones, the billionaires and millionaires are the ones that can really make an impact, because they're the ones that give to the Congress people. They're the ones that are involved, can get involved politically with their checkbooks. And they have the ability to stop some of this from happening. Now, and I don't know that he was optimistic about it. I mean, I wasn't, but, you know, I'm curious what you guys think about that. I mean, you've heard that theory before, right? The idea of the Great Dispossession. And
well, is that, are we talking about, you know, the FDIC only insures up to 250,000, but again, that's 250,000 that they're devaluing every turn they get. By the time we get it, it'll be worth essentially nothing. Is he referring to that, you think, that they could?
No, he was saying, I mean, cut off. He was saying more with the derivatives, how, you know, we learned nothing from 2008 and the derivatives are completely out of control. And the idea of the FDIC is an absolute joke, because the amount of money that they have in the fund is nothing in comparison to what's actually in the banks. So if these banks fail, or like a Fidelity or Charles Schwab, they're going to pay the secured creditors first and not the unsecured, which is like what people's, you know, 401ks or pensions are in. And the whole thing is the bailout, you know, when they did the bailouts, they're not going to do that anymore. They're going to do what's called a bail-in. And I'm saying this because I'm, you know, I'm regurgitating, because I was learning all this morning when I talked to him. But the, you know, the idea of the bail-in is using our money,
right,
to cover this. So, and then from there, transition over to the CBDC.
Mike, we have a similar stance on, okay, so Jim and I both get assaulted on X, which everyone does. Who cares, right? Nobody cares.
I like it.
But we get assaulted on X. I get called MAGA more times than I can stand. I get called right wing. I get, you know, you Trump supporters don't know what the hell you're talking about. But speaking for me, and I believe I'm speaking for Jimmy also, I give a shit about parties. Like, I could care less about political parties. You know, I have actually voted for Democrats multiple times, and I voted for Republicans probably more. For the last couple of elections, I voted Libertarian. So I want your opinion on this. Do you think, I'm very pessimistic about the future. Very pessimistic. Not about my own future. Not about my future in my household here in lovely and free Florida, but about the future of the country as we knew it as kids. So what's your opinion on that? Do you think there's hope?
No. that's a Dave Column right there, positive doomer.
That is a Dave Column.
You know, is all hope lost? No. But where all this is going, I mean, you look at internationally where we're at, you look at domestically, you look at our culture, you look at the fact that, I mean, people are just enslaved to their phones, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think an election's fixing this. I think it's way beyond that at this point. What can we do on the federal level? There's nothing we can do, but I'm just not optimistic, you know, where things are going. I mean, you guys?
That makes sense to me. And I'm not optimistic either, but I've come to a different conclusion than you. I think we keep fighting as if we're going to win, because it is the only thing that we can do. And by winning, I'm just talking about some semblance of sanity back. It's just like, it seems like over the last, I don't know, call it 20, 25 years, just everything they preach at us is like the exact opposite. Just even like little things like we need a more tolerant society. Bullshit. Society, organized society is built on lack of tolerance for certain behaviors. And I'm not talking about if adults, I will protect their right to identify with who they want to, whatever. But as soon as your rights that we give you start affecting everybody else, then I'm intolerant of that. This notion that we're made stronger by our diversity, that's bullshit. We can be made stronger by our diversity, but it's not an absolute. And I love the different cultures that I meet up with, but that's only if we can control that and tamper down. But like, we're just being fed lines of bullshit that people regurgitate and be like, yeah, well, of course we're made stronger by our diversity. Are we? No, we're not. That's crap. Am I wrong, you think, Mike?
Well, I think it's way beyond that at this point. And I, you know, when I hear the words like compromise or we need to communicate, or, you know, that's so far gone. I'll tell you an interesting story. I met with this guy last week in person, not a podcast or anything. And he was a former military guy, and he was in Venezuela when the country collapsed, like mid 2000s or 2008, 2006, somewhere in there. But it made me reflect on myself after talking to him for almost 2 hours, because he was saying how, you know, we've gotten to, you know, it used to be okay, it's okay to disagree, and it's not anymore. And, you know, he goes, when you go down the dehumanization route, that's when you start to see societies collapse. And I think we're heading that way. But also the whole idea of compromise, these people have taken it so far beyond compromise, there's just no such thing anymore.
Never again. I have
no, like you and I won't, but they, but we, like the Republican Party, like they just, they have put us in this position because they have no will to fight. Like they just, they don't have the fight in them now. I mean, they have no will to take on any of this.
Rights can only be taken away, in my opinion. They can't be given, because if they're given, they're a privilege, they're a license, right? So when you just look at, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Those are the things that are theoretically not given to us. They are what they are. They're here. We have the right to life. We have the right to liberty. We have the right to the pursuit of happiness. Everything else is theoretically at risk. But I don't agree that like rights are given. I think they can only be taken away. And one of the ones that bothers me the most, and I want both your opinions on this, is economic freedom is being slowly eroded. And what I mean by that is, as you lose the ability to earn money in different areas, and we'll go as far as if somebody, let's say that Jim knows somebody that's talented at cutting hair, right? And he's out in Arizona. Michael, you're in Arizona, right? He's out in Arizona visiting Michael. Michael's like, well, I kind of need a haircut. And Jim's like, well, my cousin here knows how to cut hair. Cut your hair, you're breaking a law, because that person doesn't have a barber's license, right? Because the government needs to license you to do things. Because if they're able to do that, then they're able to take that ability away. And as we slowly lose economic freedom, we lose all freedoms, because our fear of losing our lives because we can't feed our families and live is what controls all of it. And that's the basic right. So it's almost to me like, you know, when I hear politicians say that, you know, this is a right, but it only goes so far, they're actually saying it's not a right at that point, you know, and that's where I think we get lost. So my pessimism comes from when you look at, and now I'm going to do left versus right here, which I don't like to do, but when you look at what the left has done, they've done it in baby steps, right? Nothing has been all at once. It has not been a quick shift to trans or a quick shift to mail-in votes. It was all little baby steps, little baby steps. And I feel like if we just go into this fight mode, they're just going to keep nipping away, because the group of us that will fight is very small because of that economic freedom that's being taken away from so many people. Where'd I go wrong?
Meaning, where'd you go wrong? Like,
I guess the reason I'd like to see compromise versus fight is because I think people lose their have been losing their economic freedom, their ability to feed themselves and their family, and they're scared to death of it, so they won't fight. So it's like the three of us. It's like Pickles Joyce against the three of us.
Yeah.
Can't win.
Knock the shit out of Pickles Joyce.
Yeah.
Well, I think people have to ask themselves, you know, what is worth the fight? During the revolution, I mean, people had their Bible and, you know, they were willing to give up their lives and sacrifice for the betterment of their families and betterment of the next generation, their current generation, the next generation. We don't have that fight in us. And I think COVID showed us that. I mean, people just surrendered. Don't take away their Netflix. Don't take away their porn, Doritos and weed and video games, right?
Something that Michael just hit on, which I think is genius, and I think it is so interconnected and nobody really points to it as much, is physical fitness, physical strength, and how that compares to you being an individualist and you believing you can stand on your own. I think the two things are very, very closely connected. And we have a society that is fat getting fatter. You mentioned sitting at home watching Netflix, eating Doritos, and watching porn, which I will fight for anyone's right to do that. But we have morphed into a society of a bunch of people. It's like victim mentality. And that goes along. And in life, you see the bullies and you see the bullied. Everybody, it's so easy to just 100% blame the bullies. I considered every bully of mine as an opportunity. And I do, if we eliminate all that, people have to stand up for themselves, and nobody does that. Does any of that make sense, or is that just a nonsensical rant?
No, I mean, we have a society today that, and you know, and I was one of those people. I mean, I think I told you this, Jim, but I know Bobby, you and I touched about it. I mean, I'm only 5'5", and at one point I weighed 280 pounds.
Oh, yeah.
And it fluctuated. And then last May I went from 200 to like 153 right now. I've kind of gone between 146 and 150, 155. it was a conversation I actually had on my podcast with a doctor in London, and he pointed out some things to me. He's like, you know, you can't be an anti-vaxxer and eat like shit. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Good point. But you know, we as in, you know, people don't want to hold themselves accountable for anything, you know, and you grow up eating garbage food your whole life. Parents are distracted, especially now. Parents are distracted by phones. Parents are, you know, so they're occupied. So they give their kids whatever they can, fast food or, you know, something quick. You know, I mean, I think it's better today than maybe when I was growing up. I mean, I grew up in the TV dinner phase where eating McDonald's and Domino's and Cokes and drinking Cokes and breakfast starts, if you remember those.
Yep, I do.
But people, you know, it's hard. Like, it's hard to run every day or go to the gym every day. Or, I mean, it's part of our lives now. But, I mean, every time I wake up in the morning, I mean, I have a lot more bad runs than I do good anymore, but you know, I do it every day.
It's funny you say that. Jimmy and I were in Miami this past weekend. We were both on a panel and then we had a breakout session, and I got there with the goal of finding the best Cuban sandwich in Miami. Both of you know that I've been, I can't count this weekend, but been fairly strict carnivore for about going on almost 8 months now, 7-8 months. And it's been life-changing physically for me. And by the way, Dr. Sean Baker is coming on next week.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it'll be about 2 weeks before that show is released. I've just got like a stack of questions for him. But anyway, Cuban sandwiches obviously have bread, right? So I was eating bread and I came back. And today was the first day that I got back into my normal routine, which is a 10-mile or more bike ride one day and then weights the next. And then I'll take maybe 1 or 2 days off. And today was hell, just going 10 miles. It was hell. I was 3 minutes slower than normal, and it was absolute hell. And it is that consistency that you mentioned, Michael, and that I know Jimmy is like a nut like you are, like he doesn't miss. You know, we were in the same hotel, and at one point, Jimmy's like, yeah, so I was in the park this morning, exercise. I'm like, I was having a shot in the bar, and he was in the park. Exercising, chasing around the dog. But that takes me to a question that actually, Michael, you don't have children, right? Jimmy does.
No.
Okay, so this is more for Jimmy, but I'd like your comment on it. Like, Jimmy, you're lucky enough to have good kids. But when we go back to this idea of fighting versus trying to persuade and trying to kind of compromise, right? You're lucky enough to have good kids. But to Michael's point, phones, TikTok, all this other stuff, they've developed these attention spans that are this big. Now, Jimmy also has an attention span that's this big, but it's bigger than a TikToker, right?
Mine's half that then.
Okay, good. So you guys are short attention span.
Easily distracted.
As a parent, Jim, and then Michael, or your comment, please, how do you just say, look, you're not doing this anymore. That's it. I'm taking this away from you. How does that work? Does it work?
No, that doesn't work. And I remember there was a girl on my block when I was growing up whose parents felt the same thing about TV. This was one of the most important lessons I ever learned. Her name was Amy. I'm still friendly with her. But anyway, she came over to my house for a birthday party. We were about 10 years old. And she was entranced by the television and couldn't take her eyes off it because it was on. And I remember even like learning that lesson as a young kid, that it doesn't work to be that hard line on that. So what we instituted rules, which are, by the time they were late teenagers, you know, these rules were out, which was fine. They had the shelf life of like, if you're watching TV, you can't be on your phone and watching TV at the same time. If you start to get on your phone, we have to turn the TV off because it's only one thing time. Because I worry about just bing, bing, bing with always being entertained. But again, I have girls. I think this world for young men is way, way worse and way, way harder than it is for girls. If you ever read Richard Reeves' book of Boys and Men, if you haven't, please do. It goes into that deeply. And you're there with the, you know, already somewhat addictive personalities, like in gambling addicts, you know, 98% of them are male, 2% are female. Now throw in video games and shit like that. And all of a sudden young men have other things to chase besides beer and girls in school. You know, there's something that taking the place of that. Go.
So Michael, to you then, it is sort of the, say, let's call them the 28 to 45 year olds, that we kind of have to convince that things have gone awry. So is it the same? Because I have liberal friends. I have conservative friends. You guys are both conservative-ish friends of mine, right? But with liberal friends, they say something and I feel enraged. Like I want to just grab them and shake them. A friend of ours, James Fishback, wrote a really good article about book banning. and how the media has reported book banning, and it's actually the opposite, where more of these sort of woke books are available than any other book, and the conservative books are basically already banned for the most part in school libraries. So how do you convince people by saying, look, this is wrong, you got to fight?
Yeah, this is tough. I mean, it's kind of like the COVID thing, the people that are still wearing masks, right? Like, my arm isn't long enough to pull them out of that rabbit hole. And people believe what they want to believe. I mean, I believe what I want to believe. You know, but I actually, I mean, I have friends, I do a lot of yoga, and they're very left-leaning, and friends that I do socialize with that are the opposite. And we don't go there. Yeah. And there's times where I've had some shots thrown at me, but I just not worth getting an argument about. Although lately, I mean, I've been a little more, it hasn't happened in a while, but a little more kind of jaggedy, because I see where we're at as a country. And to me, it's like, how can you not, if you're still saying to me like Donald Trump mean tweets, like you just have no idea what's going on. I mean, so here's a perfect example in Arizona last week. Did you see the abortion that was held up, the 1864 law? Made national news, but, you know, obviously here it was huge. I saw so many people, I didn't even know this was like on the docket, but the Arizona Supreme Court upheld the law, I'm butchering it here, but that the abortion now is, it's very difficult to get an abortion in Arizona. And they held the law that was put into place in 1864. Mind you, I had no idea this was even on the Arizona Supreme Court. So it hit the airwaves, and I saw people, they're like, we just went back 50 years. Women I know that are in their, my age, mid-40s, that are like, we need to call local officials, we won't be silent about this. And I'm just like, okay, first of all, you're not having an abortion. You're not having kids anymore. Are you planning, like the younger people, are you having an abortion this week or something? Like, how is this impacting you? And third, in Arizona, we got a wide open border I've never heard you talk about. We got gas prices like four something a gallon here right now. Back to the border, we got fentanyl coming across, getting shipped all over the country, killing hundreds of thousands of people every single day. But you don't want to talk about that. I saw that. I was like, you know, this is why our society is doomed to fail. Because people just, they don't get it. They just don't get it. So I don't, there's nothing I can say. I mean, I can say that to them. But then they'll come back with, well, that's women's rights. You're trying to take away our rights. Okay, you're hopeless. What
guys took away your right to move around at will when they locked you down? What side of the aisle took away your rights when they made you know, vaccine mandates? By the way, we had Kevin Roberts on our show, the president of the Heritage Foundation, and I brought up the abortion issue because my belief is this, and this is not an emotional belief and this is not a political belief. This is just what I've seen. The abortion issue is the one thing standing in the way from really defeating the Democrats. That's the thing that they have, because they can spin it into these men, these rich white men are telling you what you can and can't do with your body, which, by the way, I am completely in the middle on this. I don't know. I know where I am. Abortion itself, I think, is repulsive, but I'm talking about the legality of abortion, which is a totally separate issue. I think that if the Republicans stood back and took a libertarian viewpoint on it, said that we think it is repulsive, we think it is abhorrent. However, it is not our business to get in the way of, to keep you from committing a sin or whatever you want to call it. That's not our thing. Enforcement of it is ridiculous. Do you guys think that would swing things back the other way? Both of you, Bobby first.
Abortion's a weird one for me as an issue itself, because if you were to say that abortion is murder, then you have to tell tens of thousands of really good people that they committed murder, right? So it's a very difficult one for me. I know what I think about it personally, and I always keep that to myself. What I liked about the elimination of Roe v. Wade, now, I'll get to your question, Jimmy. I'm sorry. Just, this is a weird one for me, right?
Me too.
What I liked about it is I thought Roe v. Wade was a bad decision, you know, and I think we have to be as much as we possibly can strict constitutionalists. And it seemed to me like that was a decision, as much as I can possibly understand about constitutional law, being as dumb as I am. It's up to the states, and that's where it should be. And by the way, it's been winning in a lot of states. Abortion has been winning. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's what stopped the predicted red wave was the Supreme Court decision.
Same.
Now, I don't care if Republicans win. I wanted Vivek Ramaswamy to win. I want people that I believe in to win. You know, I want independent thinkers who are constitutionalists to win.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about these people on the left, you have to give them credit. You have to give credit where credit's due, right? They stick together and they hit you at all angles and they never stop. They get knocked down, they get right back up. Coming back to what I said about Republicans, they have no will to fight. So what do I think it would have changed the outcome either in, well, 2022? No, I don't. They have such a system now with this ballot harvesting and drop boxes. I don't trust these machines either. So they have that aspect of it. Yeah, they take advantage of everything they can, right, to convince people, you know, how bad the MAGA and how bad the people on the right. But do I think it would have changed the outcome? No, I don't. And that's why I have no faith in 24.
And to Michael's point, there's a county in California, and I can look it up if it's important to you guys, but there's a county in California that passed an ID mandate. You need a photo ID to vote. And they're severely limiting ballot. They're going to monitor ballot boxes. There's going to be 24-hour monitoring of ballot boxes. They're going to severely limit who can use a ballot box as opposed to voting in person. I believe it's the Attorney General. I should look it up because I don't want to put something out there that's wrong. But I believe it's the Attorney General of California is suing the county for this.
They'll never let that happen. Sorry. They'll never let that happen.
They're actually suing the county for deciding how to run their own elections, saying that it's going to disadvantage marginalized people from voting, which... These are the things. Like, there are some things that just don't pass the fucking smell test, you know, where and this is what gets me, Michael, with your friends on the left, my friends on the left, Jimmy, yours, when they say things and I look at them and I say it in my own head. I'm like, I know you're not dumb. I know you're not dumb because I wouldn't be friends with you if you're this stupid and you see things like this and you actually believe it. I want to ask you if I could, Michael. Sorry, Jimmy, I jumped into something completely different. You had Patrick Henningsen, am I saying his name right?
Yeah.
Henningsen on. And you guys had a really good conversation about how news expires, right? Basically how, you know, a story happens and then the next day it's not the story anymore. Do you think that advantages one side over the other?
That's a good question. When you said that, talking about Patrick, I ended that conversation. Did you guys see The Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know.
Oh, you didn't see it? All right. So, Jim, you know, in the beginning, he takes Leonardo DiCaprio to lunch and he's like, this is a carousel, 24/7, 365. We never get off. And that's how I feel this is. I mean, you guys have been in this longer than I have, but the cycle is just so fast and it's a carousel. And you can't hang on to these conversations when you're talking about like Israel, Iran, or Russia, Ukraine, or anything that's prevalent because it could expire in literally hours. So Bobby, you asked me if it favors one side or the other that it moves so quickly.
The news cycle, yeah, or the lack of attention span, whatever you want to call it.
Well, I definitely think the lack of attention span because people just don't want to, you know, getting involved like in your communities, locally, state, federal. It's not very exciting. It's easier to just be on your phone or, you know, watching, going out, drinking wine and Desperate Housewives or fantasy football or, you know, we lost our love of country, you know? I mean, people have taken it for granted. Like, people shit on this country. It's unbelievable. And that comes back to the conversation I had with a guy last week who was in Venezuela. And he said, you know, people don't realize how good they have it here. You know, like, if our currency collapsed, I'll be probably crying in my beer. But I've been fortunate, and, you know, to talk to people that have been in these third world countries that have been there, like, when societies collapse or when, you know, like, in the midst of it, and hyperinflation and so I get a little bit of their point of view from it. Man, I mean, we live in a great place. I mean, we're talking like this. I'm drinking coffee. I'm not as engaged as maybe like other people that are more involved in the local community, but I do care. And I'm interested in learning about this stuff. And people just, how many times have you heard when you're talking to people, I don't know about you guys, but this like consumes my life now. And, you know, and I enjoy talking to people that are also interested in it. When I hear people like complain about something, it's like, fuck, man. Like, we're on the brink of nuclear war. Not the brink, but, you know, it's
we're
more
closer than
talked
we were
about.
When you and I talked.
Yeah. And every day is like another day of, you know, where is this all going to go? Because it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
Bobby, to your question about, you know, the news cycle and how it shifts our attention real quickly. A couple of weeks ago, there was a young man shot in Chicago. The police shot him 96 times.
Yep.
Hit him like 30 times. And you could feel that the news in Chicago wanted this to be George Floyd. There was no question about it. They were so excited. They were literally frothing at the mouth when they reported it. And the video was released of all the shooting. People noticed pretty quickly, though, that the kid fired first and fired at the cops 11 times. And they realized within like the first couple hours that this story was going to get no traction because people are dumb, but they're not that dumb. Mm. And all of a sudden it was just like, oh yeah, that's gone. You know what I mean? On to the next thing where we think we can hook you in with. And really that saddens me that our media, and I believe that our media is, which by the way, we talked at the beginning of the show about podcasting and why we do it. Let's not forget that part. The media has been captured by sponsorship. The media has been captured by dollars. We are going to destroy them in the long end. And it is not, I mean, we're good at what we do, all three of us here, as far as the media aspect of it goes. But it's more about how they have dropped the ball and then kicked the ball a mile away. They are going to be the easiest foe to defeat on the planet. And I have no question there. That was just a rant. Michael, what do you got for that?
No, I wanted to ask you, kind of shifting here a second, is, you know, being your restaurant owner and life in Chicago, will you go downtown during the day?
I do. I still go downtown every day, but I cannot take public transportation in Chicago anymore. And by the way, I'm going to go on what I hope is going to be a pretty funny tirade about trying to get my $80 back from the CTA that I have on my venture card because I can't ride the goddamn blue line anymore because it's terrifying because there's usually like 12 different homeless people there. Some of them getting kind of irate about something or other. Another one will like have his shoes off and like black frostbitten feet up on the chair. Like the whole thing is you call it a third world country. The blue line in Chicago is a third world country, but I still go into the city. I still know the city well enough that I know what neighborhoods to go to recreationally, but it is decidedly worse than it was, you know, several years ago. It's sad as hell.
So like on a Friday or Saturday night, you would still go down there? And
I would, but only because I know exactly where to go. And by the way, I don't go to the Loop anymore. Like the Loop, which used to be the pristine, the beautiful part of Chicago, the Loop on Michigan Avenue on weekends, I want to be far away. It becomes so, it's like a free for all. There's people, they close it down and drag race. There's people all over the place, and I don't give shit what color they are. That is not any of my concern. When someone's drag racing on Michigan Avenue and the streets closed down, we are not on the same team. Now, that being said, there's still some wonderful neighborhoods on the north side that are still excellent, in my opinion. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just the lawlessness in these cities that are just collapsing. And it's happening here in Phoenix. It's happening in Cleveland, where I'm from.
Here's something funny, though. You know, we had a problem in Chicago with illegal street racing where people would come out and block off streets and then have illegal street racing. So there's one big incident where, like, it's thousands of people, it seems like, there. The street's blocked off for, like, 2 hours. One person gets arrested. The very next day, Lori Lightfoot, the mayor, announces a contract with NASCAR that they're going to have a huge street race in Chicago. So, like, it's one of our biggest problems at the time. And they're going to go, well, let's just legalize it, essentially, and we'll have a legal street race in Chicago, which, by the way, my daughter was at, and she said it was a lot of fun. But that's not the point. The point is that how completely tone deaf is that to the problem? So it's crazy. Bobby?
The problem with Chicago to me is, and Jimmy and I, you and I talked about this in Miami. I have friends who still live there, and they get very upset when I speak like this. And I want to reach out right now to everyone who watches this, listens to this, that I know in Chicago. You didn't build the city. So I'm not going to criticize you for liking to live there or wanting to live there. Okay, you didn't build it. I still love you. I'm not trying to offend you guys, okay? But it's a shithole. And the reason I say that is because I lived
it's
there.
It's a little bit of a shithole, Michael. Well, it's not as much as
here's what. No, here's where I want to get. I lived there. And yeah. Living there is untenable now. And it's not just me saying that, right? I left because it became too dangerous and too expensive. And those are two things I never wanted to have together. I lived in dangerous neighborhoods before, deliberately, trying to earn money on the property that I got in the dangerous neighborhood over the course of years, right? But then it became too dangerous and too expensive. It's one of those two had to go. It either had to be cheaper or less dangerous, but now it's dangerous and expensive. And that's what got me to leave in the first place. When we came and spent a month in Florida, we actually, this is going to take a long time, Michael, so I'm sorry about this. We actually got down here on May 27th. The riots started on May 29th. We're watching them on TV. And when we got back to our home on the near south side of Chicago, I used to ride my bike to the Chicago Board of Trade from my house, right? We went from one gunshot a month that was far away to one gunshot a week that was close. And the police presence had lightened up dramatically. And so we said, we need to go, because when my wife is walking our dogs and she comes home with a 9mm shell casing, every 2 weeks. I'm like, no, we're not staying here anymore. We went to lunch with her old boss, who owns a restaurant in the city, lives across the street from the restaurant. And we're like, you want us to come down and have lunch? He goes, no, I don't want to have lunch here. He came out to the suburbs to have lunch with us when we were in Chicago, in the suburbs of Chicago, because spending too much time there wildly increases your odds of something happening to you. And he said, the problem isn't even murders anymore, although the numbers are high. It's robberies and burglaries. He said there were 8 to 12 robberies a day in a neighborhood that he used to hang out in. He doesn't hang out in that neighborhood anymore. That's coming from him. And he was a staunch Democrat, and he's not anymore. That's sort of like my take on it. But now, to your point, Michael, about local government, I'm now in this weird place in Florida in a gated community where, like, we have a homeowners association. And I joined the social committee to be part of homeowners association government, because you literally can't get more local than that, right? I'm literally a part of my homeowners association, trying to dictate what happens to me on a day-to-day, as opposed to who's president, which only affects me from an aggravation standpoint. I think
you know, it's those types of things and what you're doing. That's the most important right now, because whatever happens at the federal state level, well, state somewhat, but federal, there's not much we can do. Mm-hmm. And what's crazy to me is, like, people. I know people that are afraid of a nuclear war, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm not worried about that. If it happens, yeah. I hope it lands right here where I'm at.
Right on my head.
I don't want to survive that. Do you want? Yeah. Would you want to survive that?
No interest.
I hope it hits me right at the intersection, right where I live. I don't even need to see the light at that point. Right?
That's pretty cool.
An excellent point. Bye. Yeah, like the asteroid. I mean, we've gotten to a bad spot. Which, by the way, like, the whole tone of this show is doom and gloom. I still think there's some wonderful things. You know, no, I'm doom and gloom myself. It just occasionally I try to fight that battle. Like, when you're traveling along Lakeshore Drive on the way to the Cubs game on a beautiful sunny day, there is still some good things to pull out of Chicago.
Are you a Cubs fan or a White Sox fan, Jimmy? I'm sorry.
I have full teeth. Means I'm a Cub fan.
Yeah, this is a Cub show.
I had a Cub fan. I interrupt you. I had a Cub fan one time. I started talking about the grocery store. Because, you know, I'm originally from Cleveland. So I'm a big Indians guy. They changed the name of the team, and I kind of just lost interest in baseball in general. But this guy, this asshole, was like, started breaking my balls about the Indians. We lost the World Series. So I came back at him, and I'm like, I thought only real Chicago baseball fans were White Sox fans. And man, was he pissed.
That's a good dig.
I heard that a long time ago. Somebody said that to me.
They say that all the time. Well, there are plenty of real baseball fans who are Cub fans.
I would say that Jimmy and I are two of about 300 of us that actually know baseball.
But, exactly right. But you go there, and it is like it's a party at Wrigley Field. But it is also like a museum of baseball history, too, somewhat, if you know where to look and how to do it. Yes. No, someone who knows nothing about baseball can go to a game at Wrigley Field on a Friday and have the greatest time of their life and not even notice anything about the baseball game. That's one of the reasons it's gotten the reputation of not being about the baseball. It's more about the party.
Can I tell you why I think, Michael, being a Cubs fan is better than being a Sox fan? And by the way, that was a spectacular dig. Because that is the stereotype.
He was pissed. He was so pissed. Yeah. It was hilarious.
That's what you say to every Cubs fan, and they get aggravated. But I have enough stress in my day-to-day life. I actually, as a Cubs fan, I had season tickets to the old Comiskey Park for 2 years just because they were cheaper and easier to get, right? And I just love baseball. I went to Comiskey, and man, were they miserable when the game was going wrong. Like, these fans would be in the stands. They'd be cussing and throwing things. Why do I even come here? God, I'm going to beat my wife when I get home. Just out of their minds, right? Whereas Cubs fans are like, oh, we're losing? Whatever. Take me out. And I have enough stress in my regular life where baseball's supposed to be fun. And Cubs fans have fun at every damn game.
Your Chicago people always used to crack me up, though, because they would always be like, oh, Cubs, the drought, blah, 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 the curse. I'm like, you know what? I don't want to hear that. Like, I'm from Cleveland, okay? And this is before LeBron won the title, so I don't feel this way anymore. Finally brought a title. But City of Cleveland had not celebrated a championship in anything, baseball, basketball, football, since 1964. And that was with Jim Brown, with the Browns, and the Super Bowl had not been created yet.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, Kyrie Irving hit that three-point shot in Game 7 of the Warriors. Because you imagine, if the Cavs don't win that, and then the Indians are up 3-1 against the Cubs that same year and blow the series, they would have made another Believe Land Part 2 on ESPN if they wouldn't have done. I mean, so like Chicago people just crack me up. They're like, well, the Cubs, get the fuck out of here. You had the most dominant basketball team in the 90s.
Ever.
Yeah, very dominant hockey team in the 2000s.
Well, I never really associated hockey because Cleveland, we didn't have hockey. So I looked at like the three, the baseball, basketball, football.
Sure.
But the greatest basketball team probably ever. I mean, maybe the Bill Russell Celtic team. The only sad thing about that whole thing was, you know, they didn't come back that next year. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to have seen if the Spurs with Duncan and Robinson, they won it the next year. I think the Spurs won it that next year. I would have been curious.
The Bulls were done.
Was that the Spurs the first year?
Well, in between the Bulls runs was the Rockets.
Yeah.
And then right after the Spurs began, so I wouldn't be surprised if the next year was the Spurs.
It was the Spurs. They beat the Knicks with the Charles Sprewell and Patrick Ewing. That was Duncan. Right. Duncan's second year, maybe it would have been his rookie year.
Underrated player, Tim Duncan, man.
Oh my God! Well, and the Bulls, though, they were running out of gas, and you saw that in the documentary that they were getting tired of each other and just running out of steam. So I almost wish they would have lost, so you never would have wondered. But I wonder if they'd have come back that next year, would they have finally got overthrown? I mean, eventually, you know, they would have got overthrown, but I wish they would have kept going until they lost.
By the way, the Bulls drafted Michael Jordan in 1984. In 1985, we also had the single most iconic football team ever in the NFL that, you know, walked through the playoffs destroying people that around the world, they still tell legends of the 85 Bears. You know what I mean? So we talk about lucky. If you're Chicago fans and they start telling you you're not lucky with sports, they're crazy, to your point.
Yeah. Well, how about Cleveland? I mean, you're speaking of, like, before LeBron won, you know, we had – I mean, people don't realize Bill Belichick. You know where his first head coaching job was?
Cleveland, yeah.
Cleveland. Do you know who his defensive coordinator was?
What's his name?
No, Nick Saban.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. For the first 3 years of Belichick, it was Nick Saban was defensive coordinator. He pulled him from Toledo to be the defensive coordinator, and then he left to go to Michigan State. But, you know, you look back before that, you had the drive with Elway, which Denver, during that time, I'm going to bore your audience, but Denver played the game of their life. Elway played the game of his life every fucking AFC championship, and he went to three Super Bowls in a row and got blown out every single one of them by the Giants, the Redskins, and the 49ers.
Didn't Ernest Biner drop the ball on the goal line once?
That was next year. That was the fumble. The drive was in Cleveland, and then the fumble was in Denver. And then you get Belichick, who is our head coach, who actually had the team in the right direction, but then his last year they announced a move, and when they moved to Baltimore, they didn't bring him with them. Now you have the Indians in 97 that was one out away against the Marlins, which the Marlins bought that team that year, and then they dismantled it after they won the World Series. And then you have the greatest NBA player of our generation, who's from Northeast Ohio, who gets drafted by the Cavs, who leaves to go to Miami. And you're like, because that they'll never get a guy like that again.
No, there's never guys like that. Yeah.
No. And then the fact that he was from Northeast Ohio and like got drafted by the Cavs. The Cavs got the number one pick that year. But again, it was just a compelling story because he came back and he won the title and whatever. But all these things Cleveland had, and then Cleveland moves to Baltimore, and, you know, they eventually won a Super Bowl.
Hold on, who moves to Baltimore?
Cleveland, 97, the Browns.
Oh,
the Browns became the Ravens.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then who are the Browns? Like, the Browns just started a new team, or is it?
They started a new team, and Al Lerner, who I actually worked for his company at that time, he thought, oh, I'll just bring the 49ers management in. So he brought in Carmen Policy as the president.
Okay.
Dwight Clark is the GM, and that didn't last long, 2 or 3 years, and he fired them.
Wow.
He thought, I'll bring the 49ers management in, and this will be
a lot of wins.
This was just. But it was really, it just shows you, it was probably Eddie DeBartolo that was the brain behind all that, how strong the ownership was. But yeah, anyway.
Bobby, one last question before we let him go. This has been a lot of fun. I'm not sure exactly how much takeaway is from compared to our normal shows, but it's been a ton of fun. Hopefully people enjoy the conversation. Bobby, one more question?
I wanted to point out that, Michael, you're one of my favorite listeners. You really are. Because the level of guest you get that people don't know they should be listening to. This is one of those things. It's what's that Mark This is the opposite of that Mark Twain phrase, Jimmy. The one where he says, it ain't what you know that hurts you, it's what you know. No, it ain't what you don't know that hurts you.
What you know for sure, that just ain't so.
That just ain't so. Michael shows the opposite of that. Michael interviews people that you should know and that you should listen to. And that to me is it's spectacular. Like your show is just, it's the perfect length. It's the perfect guests. And you are probably every other bike ride I'm listening to one of your shows. So I just want to say thank you for being here.
Michael, before we leave, your three favorite shows, who are your three favorite guests on your show, excluding Bobby and I?
Well, I would say right now, you know, Dave Collum is up there. He's coming back on tomorrow. I've had Matt Bracken on a lot. Hopefully he'll be coming back on next week. Great, great guy to speak with, you know, former Navy SEAL. Jim Kunstler I have on a lot. He's become a friend. Yeah. And Tom Luongo, I would also say. I know you gave me more three.
Great. Yeah, he was on our show. He was so fun, I thought. Yeah.
And then you know, Travis Haley, he's a reconnaissance Marine, and Jim Fuller, who makes AKs here in town. So yeah, I had them both on mid-February. And Jim Fuller is makes a Kalashnikov AKs. Well known. Most well-known, recognized AK maker in America.
I just assume that the AKs, because they were Kalashnikovs, they were made in Russia or something. They're made here?
Yeah, well, they get the parts. Have the parts brought in. But it's getting tougher. It's getting tougher, I think, for them to get the parts.
Find Michael Ferris. It's Coffee and a Mic. And it is a show that you should be listening to. It's fantastic. Remember what Michael's mission is and what ours is, too. Bobby and I were in mainstream media for a long time. We got forced out because we wouldn't toe the line. And we wouldn't give the opinions they want us to get. Mainstream media is captured by the sponsorship money. Even the opinions you are hearing on the mainstream media are being molded by that money. Bobby and I's opinions may be bullshit and wrong, but at least there are genuine opinions. But none of this works without you guys watching us, support us, and liking us, and retweeting us. And we are extremely appreciative for that.
Thank you so much for having me on.